Mr. Warner?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor. 5 minutes, please.
That's fine. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. This appeal involves the construction of two sentences in Section 15 of the property settlement agreement entered into by the parties in February 25, 2000, which was incorporated into a decree of divorce in April 10, 2000.
Can I just ask one basic question?
Yes, Your Honor.
I assume there's no dispute between the parties that Brian Green Jr. was covered by the insurance at that time.
At the time the agreement was signed? Mm-hmm. None, Your Honor.
There's no dispute over that?
No.
Because I didn't see any evidence of insurance in the record, and I may have missed it.
I don't think you missed it. I don't think it was there.
Okay. Thank you.
In the property settlement agreement, the two sentences say the husband agrees to maintain the minor children as beneficiary of his present medical hospitalization policy for so long as they may be entitled to said coverage. That sentence has as its noun, minor children. And the sentence, the plain meaning of the sentence is that...
Can I ask you on that, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but your time goes by so fast here, as you know. If we have to look not just at paragraph 15, but at the whole agreement, right? The whole PSA. And my question is, why minor children would not be descriptive of the children at the time the agreement was signed when you look not only at paragraph 15, but at 14, which talks about the minor children and the requirement to establish life insurance and to keep the life insurance in place until they're 22. And even more so, paragraph 16, which refers to the minor children, but requires that the parties pay for 4 years of college for them.
So yes, sir.
If your argument is taken to its logical conclusion, wouldn't that mean that in paragraph 16, where it refers to the minor children, that they could only, Mr. Green and Ms. Robertson, would only have to pay college tuition and expenses until the children turn 18?
I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor. There's no restriction of parties agreeing to provide benefits for minor children after they reach the age of majority. And clearly where paragraph 16 says contribute on behalf of their children first, not minor children. And then clearly
says minor children in that paragraph.
In the next part of that sentence, it does. But it's clearly providing for college, which is something that is not done during high school. Likewise, in the case cited by Ms. Robertson, the Holbitz case, in that agreement, the agreement itself said that the husband agreed to provide the medical insurance for the child so long as he may reasonably be able to provide it. In the decree of divorce, that was subsequently changed to say minor children, for so long as they are eligible for health insurance. And the Court of Appeals recognized that that change in wording presented an issue because if you could read those two things as inconsistent because one referred to minor children, the other referred to the name of the child who happened to be a minor. And certainly the parties can agree to obligate themselves past the age of majority. There's no doubt about it.
Why, but if you're agreeing to obligate yourselves in paragraph 16 on the college expenses, couldn't they agree to obligate themselves past the age of 18 on paying for the health expenses not covered by the insurance?
They could. The question is whether they did. And at the time the agreement was signed, and that was in the record, the maximum age that a child could be covered under the federal insurance was the age of 21.
But I know you said that under the federal insurance, but I remember when I was in law school, I was on my parents' insurance. That was a while ago. That was certainly well before the Obamacare Act.
Yes.
So if the insurance company allowed it and they were eligible or entitled under that policy, why, particularly since the second sentence of paragraph 15 only says children, it doesn't say minor children. The parties agree to share equally the cost of any medical or dental expenses of the children not covered by said insurance. It says of the children at that point.
It does, Your Honor. It refers back to said insurance.
But it does say said insurance.
And since there's no expiration date in the second sentence, and we must construe the contract to be complete, the reasonable interpretation would be that it's as long as said insurance was in place. Otherwise, the obligation in paragraph 2 could extend until the children are 65, because it's possible
most insurance companies generally don't allow you to keep children on policies.
Right.
65. That's one reason I was asking why the policy wasn't in here.
Well, if number 2 is not tethered to number 1, then, though, the said insurance, then the age at which insurance cuts off wouldn't be the expiration date for 2. It's only if you tie it back to 1 that they have the same expiration date.
Mr. Orr, I'd like to come back to maybe a more fundamental question that I have in this case. It looks to me like this case in the trial court started out on two kind of parallel tracks. One was a suit for breach of contract, and one was a contempt proceeding. Is that fair?
It started as a contempt proceeding. In the middle, they asked for leave to amend to add breach of contract, which they then non-sued.
Okay. So it proceeded to final order, or at least the final order, granted the demur on one of the breach of contracts and dismissed the contempt, did it not?
It didn't dismiss it, but it found Mr. Green not in contempt.
The defendant is held not in contempt.
Not in contempt.
Right.
And that the facts were not sufficient, the court added further to find him in contempt.
The Supreme Court in 2011, in Jenkins v. Mira, held that there was no appellate jurisdiction, at least in the Supreme Court, to appeal a finding that someone is not held in contempt. And we subsequently, Newton versus Jones, we subsequently held, based on Jenkins v. Merritt, that we did not have jurisdiction over an appeal of a finding of no contempt. So my question is, why do we have jurisdiction?
The parties didn't challenge that, and the reason is actually my second argument that substantive due process gives everybody their day in court to have their arguments heard. And the second argument, which I haven't addressed and probably won't because of time, but it's in my brief, it's our position. Once Judge Sharp found that Mr. Green was not in contempt, then that should have been the end of the case. Because
and that's where I kind of agree with you, that whatever the trial judge did in terms of announcing his opinion on the merits is really an advisory comment. If you don't pay it and you come back again, you may find that he enforces that. But as far as this particular order, I don't see how we have any jurisdiction to adjudicate it.
That's one of my arguments, Your Honor, because I believe that is the case. Once Mrs. Robertson made her choice of the pleadings that she filed, she really couldn't file a breach of contract, which is why she filed it and then withdrew it, because this contract was incorporated and merged into the decree. So there was no contract anymore.
We have to, in order for us to be to decide the case, we have to wait until the trial judge actually enters an order finding the husband in contempt and requiring him on pain of further punishment to make the payment. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think his order already orders him to pay it.
What happens if he doesn't?
I think the judge made it pretty clear he intended to find him in contempt.
But that would require a new contempt proceeding, would it not?
To find him in contempt, it would. But Mrs. Robertson made her choice. She didn't file a motion to enforce like she did, and it happens to appear in the appendix for the matter related to college costs, which is now before the court today. She chose to file solely the show cause for contempt, which put Mr. Green at risk of going to jail. And what the judge did was find him not in contempt, find that the facts weren't even sufficient to find him in contempt, but then issued an award. And so if we don't get
it, have been dealt with, right? That's not before us, as you said, the issue of the college clause.
It's not before us at all. I mean, I wasn't a party to that, a lawyer for that, so I don't even know about the case, Your Honor. But yes, but then issued an award of damages, and that's what we appealed. And so I think it's, one could interpret the statute saying you have no right to appeal finding of not contempt is you won and the case is over and the losing party can't ask that something be awarded against the other party.
You can't award damages in an action to compel compliance with a divorce decree. You award damages in a civil suit, and again, that's another area we don't have jurisdiction over. If this were a pure contract proceeding to interpret the original agreement, that would be a contract action on a contract.
Right.
Can I ask you if the court, though, has an issue before it, whether it's entitled motion to show cause or motion to enforce court's decree, if it's something that the circuit court ordered in its final decree, in that order, why doesn't it have inherent authority to issue a judgment and say you have to pay?
The court clearly has the authority, provided the matter is properly put before the court and someone has to file the right pleadings, and there's a difference in filing a motion for rule of show cause and a motion to enforce. And had Mrs. Robertson filed a motion to enforce, then the judge clearly would have had the authority to issue the damages, and we still could have been here today arguing about whether that was proper.
Your argument is that in her affidavit and petition for rule to show cause, I guess that's what we're talking about, tell me if it's not.
Right.
That when she argued that he be held in contempt, that was the first thing. And
right.
Then second, that defendant be required to immediately reimburse the plaintiff for a share of the child's uncovered medical expenses. And third, that the defendant be punished for his contempt. And fourth, defendant be incarcerated. And fifth, that the defendant be required to pay all attorney's fees and costs. That when you ask for all of that and you title it petition to show cause, you can't do any of those things that under that motion to the court, that petition, as far as getting the $7,000 reimbursed. You can't do that. You could only do the show cause related matters.
You can, but the cause of action, if you will, is a determination by the court that the defendant's in contempt, and then the court would award that amount sought. But when the cause of action is asked for contempt and the court finds no contempt, in fact, sufficient not to find contempt, and there has been her choice, Ms. Robertson's choice, not to file for enforcement, yes, that's our position.
That's
Mr. Warner, I neglected to mention to you, you're well into your rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we peppered you with a lot of questions, so I'll extend that just briefly so you'll have a moment or two and certainly give Mr. Deal an equal opportunity.
Thank you.
If the court may please, I'm Lawrence Deal. I'm here on behalf of Sharon Robertson, the appellee.
Mr. Deal, could I pose to you the same question about our jurisdiction?
Yes, sir.
This is an order that dismisses a show cause, dismisses a contempt proceeding, and it's pretty clear that we don't have jurisdiction over that. The only anomaly here is I think the trial court may have announced what it was thinking before it dismissed the contempt proceeding.
I'm going to address that because I disagree that they didn't have the authority. But let's talk about jurisdiction. I would agree that the cases that you cited, you know, jurisdiction can be raised at any time. You either have it or you don't. And so I didn't raise it at the time, given the benefit, I guess, of the kind of other issues that may or may not be within that scope. Anecdotally, the Boyd Graves Conference, which I'm on, looked at whether we should amend our statute to allow that to be done, but we've elected to leave it as it is, not to overburden and get more issues before this court. So, yeah, probably so. So the answer is, if it's jurisdictional and the only scope of what we're dealing with here is under the umbrella of a show cause that was found not to have sufficient facts, then I would agree that this doesn't have jurisdiction. But let me address some of the substantive issues. I think.
But you didn't argue that in your brief.
I did not. Did not argue.
Okay.
So if we don't have jurisdiction, why isn't this the end of it? At least at this stage.
Would be the end of it. But
we make jurisdiction sua sponte quite often. In fact, we're required to.
Frankly, I guess I didn't think about it, and I apologize to the court because I should have, but the answer is if it's jurisdictional, it's jurisdictional.
Right.
And me or anybody else would have that issue. But still, in case the court decides to look at the substance of the issues, I think Judge Beals read my first page I was going to argue, and that is that in the you look at an agreement in its whole to find out what the terms in the agreement mean. And I have here 14 and 16 where there's other provisions showing that the term minor children was used to identify a class of those people, to identify who is in the scope of an agreement, whether it's life insurance till 22, college expenses, which would obviously be beyond the majority of the children. And I'd also address paragraph 7, which talks about child support going to 18. These folks had every knowledge that this support would go to an age specific, and they could have, but they didn't address that.
Was there any evidence introduced to establish exactly what the coverage of the health insurance was at the time the agreement was signed?
Nothing.
I know in at least as far as the state insurance, for instance, it uses the word dependent. And that normal, and if a child no longer is dependent at 18, that's when health insurance terminates. But if a child is in college, it stays a dependent until age 23. We don't know what the coverage was at the time.
The answer is there was no evidence presented by anybody on that issue. The only thing that was represented was that Mr. Green had continued the coverage up and still does, I think, and pending this matter, at least, I don't think there's any evidence that it was cut off. So the answer is it would only be speculation to say what the coverage was and to what extent. But other than that, Mr. Green said, I've covered these children and continued to cover them. And that gets into the issue then of having performed the coverage continuation and paying medical bills up until the circumstances of the increased health expenses of Brian, the child that had the medical issues. I would argue that the acts of the party can show that he understood what the terms were. And I've cited the case where the husband, that was the crazy case where he says, I don't have to pay support after I get married, because there was a Scrivener's error in that case. But the fact is, this court kind of made the observation that he obviously knew about what his obligation was and continued to pay after he had remarried, and only used it later in a fairly frivolous argument that he didn't have to pay after that. But in this case, I would argue that his actions can ratify or show his recognition of that. There's arguments in the brief where he voluntarily continued that. There's nothing in the record, not one bit, that he voluntarily, that's just a conclusion argued by counsel, but there was no evidence. The fact that he continued it for whatever reason. There was no evidence that he voluntarily did it. He just did it. And I think this court can, citing some of the cases that I have in the Mickey's annotation, that you can look at one's behavior as to what they think the agreement was, if there's any dispute on the interpretation. And as far as I think there's some distinctions between is it eligible or entitlement, I don't see any substantive issue on that. Made for so long as they may be entitled. I think the word may, certainly the children were entitled, could have been entitled under Obamacare until 26. And
so
I think
you think the difference there is may it be entitled?
May is a key word.
If it were entitled,
I'd have a problem. Mm-hmm. I do think that. I wouldn't concede it here, but I do think that their agreement, and in fact, I was going to comment, their brief really talks about entitlement over and over, but they don't look at the key word, which is may be entitled. Well, certainly they may have been entitled or may have been eligible. I don't see a substantive difference between that and the Coleman's case that I've cited. The Coleman's case was insurance would cover as long as they were eligible to be independent. And here it's eligible for coverage. But may is what they agreed to. We can't rewrite it. And by reading it the way he has, this court would be rewriting the agreement by inserting a date, interpretation of the word minor children, which is inconsistent with the rest of the agreement, and all of that. I want to address the second issue about how did the court just come up with a number and order that. Page 105 of the appendix I cite, that's the part of the transcript where the judge says, you all agree that if I find that there's an entitlement, you owe the money. And they conceded that. After he had dismissed the, said I don't think there's enough evidence on the contempt, and after he had granted the non-suit on the breach of contract, they went ahead and had a whole hearing. Page 123 to 135, they had a hearing on the quantification of that amount. And the Hughes case that I've cited was a case where they reversed the contempt, but instead the judgment for a support arrearage stands. There was no other pleading under the umbrella of how that could have stood. So here, first of all, I would say that they agreed to it. Secondly, look at paragraph 22 of the order of the court. And in that order, they actually say that they agreed to the amount that was owed, as agreed by the parties. And they didn't appeal that part of it. And that's in paragraph 22 of the court's order. Third, I would follow up on
Judge... They didn't note an objection either.
They did not.
At the time of the order.
And when the judge says, let's go ahead and hear the evidence on the quantification of what was the amount, there was one item of a hotel bill that he knocked off. Everything else he found was valid. I think that was the only real issue, substantively. They went ahead and did it. No one said, no, wait, Judge, you can't do that now. You don't have any jurisdiction to do it. They went through it. At the end of the hearing, he found an amount, no objection, no exception at that time. And so the court still had the authority to do it in the inherent authority. And once it was quantified, it's a judgment. Okay.
I always get nervous when somebody says inherent authority. Inherent in what? Where does the court have the authority to order someone to pay money when the court dismisses the underlying proceeding?
And here's the answer. When you have a child support order, amounts as they accrue become arrearages, and they're judgments. Here, there was an order to pay certain things as later determined by the court. The only reason they had to have the hearing was to quantify that amount. Once he quantified it, it was a judgment under the order, no less than child support as a monthly payment. This is still part of the same court order. And I would argue that it's a judgment, and the only reason it wasn't a judgment earlier was because it had to be quantified to get that amount. And once he got that amount, he had the authority to do that, as well as the different remedies that she had asked for in the affidavit.
Doesn't the court have to have some underlying jurisdiction to proceed in order to compel someone to pay money?
Well, under the contempt part. I'm arguing that this isn't a contempt purge or anything
like
that.
But that's the only proceeding the court had before it, because it dismissed whatever contract action there was.
Well, if you look at the Hughes case, when they remanded it back, using your rationale, then there would have been no authority for them to say, but we're going to continue the arrearages even though they dismissed the contempt. There was nothing else in the Hughes case that allowed any proceeding.
Did the trial court find no contempt? I'm trying to recall.
The trial court found contempt.
Found contempt.
And what is
it? As in Zidane versus Weston, they found contempt. But we reversed them and sent it back.
Right, but the arrearage amount was still upheld, even though the contempt
right.
was dismissed.
But I think Judge Petty's question, which is what I'm now wondering too, is in Zidane and in Hughes, there was an original finding of contempt, so it could be appealed to this court. But if there's a finding of no contempt and the motion, the petition for show cause is only, because of, that's how it's set up in the trial court, how can it be appealed to this court?
Well, it can. I agree with the jurisdictional issue. I think we're talking academics right now, but I don't know, so I have to argue the residual issues here. But I'm saying that if there is, in the Hughes case, this court reversed the finding of contempt. That means that there's no contempt. and there was no other petitions under contract or any other remedies. And yet they still said the arrearage can be held. And I think I cited a Sharma case or something about the
Sharma
case, which is basically finding a judgment. I don't see any substantive difference between a child support order that a judge can enter anytime versus a amount of a quantification.
Courts have authority to enforce their own decrees, their own
Correct.
Orders. I mean, and if it's not paid, the arrearage becomes a judgment. We've got case law that says that. But I guess I'm just, how do we deal with it on this particular appeal if it all comes to us from an appeal of a petition to show cause that was denied?
Well, again, you can't affirm something that you don't have jurisdiction over anyway. So I agree. What will happen here probably is that they'll go back to the court, and then knowing the interpretation of this judge, he then might say, now it's a contempt because, you know, I told you where I am and you didn't pay. And so, you know, there'll be a procedural process of going up again if they want to, I guess, at that point.
It seems so at the trial court level, if you try to construct this in a sequential order, the court said, I've interpreted the order to mean that you owe the money. However, I'm finding that the payment or the non-payment was not willful, and therefore I dismiss the contempt. Would that be the analysis that the court didn't actually go through, but would normally go through in this kind of proceeding?
I think so. I mean, yeah, but here, again, the $7,000 that's owed, I think, represents the court's authority, not inherent, but just it's enforcing a judgment that he has now found. The difference between maybe a quantifiable $300 a month child support.
But the judgment, it's capable of being converted into a judgment. It's not a judgment automatically, is it?
Well,
a non-payment of any kind of support can be enforced as a judgment.
I disagree. I think that the law is that as a judgment accrues and not paid, it becomes a judgment automatically. And no.
But
difference.
What do you do with that judgment? You have to...
You have to
docket it and then enforce it.
Well, it's still a judgment, but then you come in and you have...
It's the avenue. I think the point that Judge Petty is making is that the current status of the case is based on the contempt proceeding.
Well, there's other remedies that the affidavit did raise independently of just that one line item.
It all comes under the umbrella of the contempt, right?
No.
I mean, I
see that the $7,000 judgment is independent. The contempt's now gone away by the trial judge. But he still had the authority to have a hearing on what was owed.
But he didn't.
Yeah, they did. That's why they found that the amount. Exactly, that's what they did. And they agreed that if there was an interpretation on look at 105 of the appendix.
So you're saying the trial judge had the authority to do that, but there's no authority no jurisdiction to appeal it. To us. Is that what I'm hearing you saying now? So we have no jurisdiction to hear the appeal. We must dismiss it or reverse it if we agree with that.
If they had raised the issue in the context of a judgment entered, which they didn't, you'd have jurisdiction. That is separate and independent of the contempt, which I agree you probably don't have, and that's under the scope of
But that's the problem. It's all under the scope of contempt, then case over, and it's got to go, as you pointed out, the trial judge may very well take it up in a different context now, being brought in a different...
Well, under Hughes and Sharma, I would say that the ability to do a judgment on the amount of the health costs is a separate, independent judgment based on a previous court order, and the court always has the right to enforce that. Maybe we're not there today because of the procedural aspect. Yeah, but I mean, if they had appealed it on that basis, I think you'd have jurisdiction over that because that'd be based on a judgment issue, but that's not been raised and not before this court.
So can I ask just one other
question? I really want to ask about fees. I have it in here, but...
Why don't we let Judge Beals ask his question first?
So based on the discussion we just had, is the proper... If assuming we decide we do not have jurisdiction, do we dismiss the appeal or do we reverse what the trial court did in the process?
I think you have to dismiss the appeal. Jurisdiction is a dismissal status.
We don't get to the merits in any way. We don't say, okay, if you didn't do what you should have done or what, any of that. It's just dismissed.
I think that's the way it would have to end up. And I've just, 2 seconds, I just asked for the fact that my client is going to lose even if she wins without some a fee award on this matter. So I'd ask to look at that, consider that. Thank you
very much, Mr. Deal. Mr. Werner.
Your Honor, he covered a lot of ground. If I could just hit the high points. I would certainly ask the court to reverse the actions taken by the trial court.
How can we do that, though, if we don't have jurisdiction?
Well, you don't have jurisdiction to someone that contests a finding of non-contempt, which I didn't appeal. And the second assignment of error was the court erred when it granted relief, ordering defendant to pay uncovered medical expenses after finding defendant to not be in contempt of the decree of divorce. Certainly, Judge, the substantive due process, that you must have authority to reverse action taken by a trial judge if what the trial judge did was improper in the context of the proceeding that occurred. Otherwise, that puts Mr. Green at a huge disadvantage. He's still facing jeopardy, and there's undoing of the action.
He's not facing jeopardy until the court enters another order finding him in contempt. He may have potential jeopardy, but no actual jeopardy at this time. Let me rephrase it. The court couldn't put him in jail for noncompliance with his order at this point, could it?
I think it would intend to, yes.
Could the court just issue a capias if Mr. Deal files information with the court saying he hadn't made the payment? Could the court just issue a capias?
I don't think a capias, but I think if Ms. Reinhardt filed to show cause with the order and said the money wasn't paid, that would be the end of the proceeding, and he would find.
But there'd have to be a new proceeding. There'd have to be a new contempt proceeding in order to enforce that, would there not?
There would, but then he might be taken away by the sheriff right then, as commonly is done when somebody's found in contempt of a court order and be in jail.
So you're saying the bottom line is, even if we dismiss and we leave in place the award, it's essentially a judgment.
It is.
And therefore, he could be quickly held in contempt if he doesn't pay the judgment.
And remanded to the sheriff. I believe that's what would occur. And that seems completely unfair and inconsistent with any sort of due process. And for this court to reverse what the judge did after finding Mr. Green not in contempt, in fact, is not sufficient. I don't think that's in violation of the statute that says you can't appeal a finding of non-contempt, because we didn't.
You could essentially immediately appeal any finding of contempt or order in that. And
have to get him out of jail. And is that the right, is that the just thing, given what happened after a finding of non-contempt?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will brief counsel, and then we will stand adjourned. Mm-hmm.